Burası Ahval. Doğru haberciliğin ve özgür yorumların odak noktası. Podcast yayınımıza hoş geldiniz.
Hello and welcome to Hot Pursuit, part of Ahval podcast video series. Today my guest is from Washington DC, Merve Tahiroğlu, director, Turkey director of Project on Middle East and Democracy, in short, POMED. Welcome, Merve.
Thank you.
Good to see you. And let's talk about the latest developments. Actually, when we decided about organizing this talk, I thought it would be based on East Mediterranean crisis, etc. But a new development, a report highlighting Erdogan and Trump, their relationship. A lot of question marks were around it, as you know. We were asking why Trump is so protective of Erdogan, so friendly with Erdogan, and we were also questioning why Erdogan is so cautious about his relationship with Trump, and also why he's putting all his eggs in Trump's basket. Part of the answers may be in this report, which is done by European Watchdog Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, OCCRP, by experienced investigative reporters. And this highlights a sort of an international network, which also gives answers about how active these two presidents were as part of this network building. But it's also more than that, maybe, because it involves many names from Ukraine, Azerbaijan, Russia, but also it highlights meetings, sort of closed-door meetings involving Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu, Trump confidant Brian Ballard, Azerbaijani Turkish businessman Mubariz Mansimov, and Lev Parnas, a Florida businessman. You know, he rose to nationwide fame in the United States in the lead up to Trump's impeachment due to his dealings with Ukraine, etc. Some of these names are very well known in the States. I know that you have been following, the patterns of some of the actors involved in this report. What is your assessment about it?
Yes, for all of us here looking at Turkey-US relations since the Trump administration took power here, this question of what exactly moves the relationship between personal relationship between Erdogan and Trump has been a very important one. And what we see with this new, this big piece of investigative journalism here is that we're able to identify now a few of those figures that made this relationship possible. We knew that the Erdogan government, and by that I mean figures close to Erdogan, not just his ministers, but also his family members and also his business friends in the business community, very powerful moguls and business people inside Turkey, well connected. We knew that they were the ones initially leading the outreach that the Turkish government was able to make to the Trump campaign and also to various lobbyists of the Trump administration. We knew that this started even before Trump was actually elected in 2016. It precedes the actual election itself. We knew that Turkey really put all of its baskets on the Trump team even before Trump won over Hillary Clinton. And we knew that there were powerful characters involved. But what we see now is all these names that you have mentioned, I can recount them. I think you forgot Giuliani, which makes the story a bit more sexy, I think, particularly from a U.S. perspective. We're seeing all of these figures who have court cases against them in the United States, in Turkey, elsewhere, for corruption, for issues like federal racketeering, for taking bribes. So what we see is a network, as you said, of Turkish and American and dash something, Turkish, Azerbaijani, American, Ukrainian, American, Russian. These international network of business people, men in particular, businessmen, who all have a shady business background and you know, involved in corruption in one way or another, basically, we now know the details of how, some of the details of how they got together with their Turkish counterparts and created this close personal tie between Erdogan and Trump and the people close to them. And I think one of the most interesting parts of this story is the people, especially the American side, the American figures here, and how, their relationship with Russia. A lot of these people have are either oligarchs themselves of Russia or are very well connected to other oligarchs in Russia. And from the United States perspective, when we talk about the domestic political agenda here, when we talk about Trump and his corruption and potential undue foreign influence on the Trump team, we always talk about the United States and Russia and maybe Ukraine as a major actor in this whole story. But I think we're seeing now that Turkey is increasingly becoming a key part of this as well, because we've always known that a leader like Trump, which has taken the United States very much a way which dismisses traditional U.S. values and foreign policy making and foreign policy approach, particularly on the international stage, valuing things like democracy, peace building, cooperation, and forgetting all of those. And Trump is a type of president that builds relationships with all any dictators and has completely stepped away from these values. We knew that this would benefit most Russia from the beginning. And there's always been a discussion of whether Turkey has almost become a tool for Russia to create a wedge between the United States and its traditional NATO allies, where Russia might be using Turkey to dampen American influence on the international stage. This has always been a question mark for analysts looking into U.S.-Turkey relationship under the Trump administration. Now we're seeing actual Russian involvement in making the relationship between Erdogan and Trump possible, which I think is a very interesting angle that this report has revealed to us.
I see. This is maybe answering some of the questions about this very interesting relationship, special relationship between two presidents. One wonders, though, where's the beef for Erdogan? What does he get out of this? This relationship, more money or prestige, legitimacy, what?
I mean, for Erdogan, I think he is the one that gets the most benefits out of this.
In what way?
From a personal capacity, and I want to separate this from Turkish national interests, because it's not Turkey benefiting from this; it's Erdogan. Both these crony relationships and the number of millions of dollars involved in all of these deals that Erdogan that business people close to Erdogan and Trump have made, and these contracts for lobbying, etc., personally help enrich Erdogan and prop up his regime at home, because we're talking about cronies that prop up his regime at home in Turkey. But also it allows Erdogan to have a direct line to President Trump here and to the U.S. president, and basically allows through that direct line, this connection that he has to Trump, to basically get the United States to stop pushing back against some of Turkey's more disruptive foreign policy decisions abroad and also domestic repression. Because this is something we've seen Trump giving Erdogan a complete carte blanche on since he came to power. He has not really pushed back against any of Erdogan's domestic repression, with the sole exception of the jailing of Andrew Brunson, the American pastor. That was when, and it's ironic that even though Erdogan has his closest relationship with this particular American leader, he's also the only one in the last 10 years that has sanctioned Turkey because of Andrew Brunson. We seem to forget about that. But except with that one exception, we haven't seen President Trump push back against any of Turkey's actions that a mainstream U.S. foreign policy maker would consider a major transgression against the alliance and the contract between Turkey and the United States. So in this way, I think this really benefits Erdogan. It shows him that he can guide Turkish foreign policy in any way that he wants, and he will always have a friend in the White House. That is, of course, not true. America, at the end of the day, is a democracy, and there's going to be an election, and Trump will not be the leader forever. And this is, I think, going to come back and really hurt the Erdogan government when America moves on from a Trump presidency.
Mm-hmm. And one also sees almost no impact of such reports, although they are meticulous. They highlight a lot of shady relations, as you say. But it's almost certain that given the almost 95% of Turkish media under yoke of Erdogan, there will be almost no reporting inside Turkey out of either pro-government media unwilling to publish any of these reports, and also the other media, alternative media, out of fear for self-censorship. Although there will be, of course, news sites such as Ahval or few others maybe, although it will not produce any impact on the perception of Erdogan. But it may be otherwise in the States, because it's approaching very critical elections, and it shows how key actor Erdogan is actually with the behavioral patterns of Trump, given in all international politics, or specifically Turkish-American relations, based on personal interests. So there may be some sort of difference between the impacts of on the leaders on both sides.
Certainly, and in the domestic national conversation in both Turkey and the U.S., as you said, the problem with investigative journalism or journalism in general in Turkey, it's a very serious one. The level of censorship that people in Turkey are under, and the pressure that creates. But so this story will likely not make as many headlines, particularly given the EastMed dominating the headlines right now in Turkey. But in the United States, I think it has the potential of becoming a key component of the domestic conversation, because Trump is a very controversial president. We are about to go to another election in November, just a month from now. Right before the pandemic, there was an impeachment process that Trump was under, directly relating to Trump's foreign relations. And yes, Ukraine and Russia are always going to, because they are the number one, Russia remains the number one adversary of the United States on the international stage. Those are the main countries that we talk about when we talk about Trump's corruption and relationship with foreign actors and involvement in the domestic politics of other countries. But we are seeing with reports like this that Turkey, in fact, is also a key player here, and just as important as a country like a space like Ukraine, for example. Mm-hmm. So I think as we get closer to the election, we might be hearing Turkey and President Trump's relationship with Erdogan, its corruption, its shady ties, its darkness, all of these come to the fore in the U.S. National conversation in the next month.
So I think the reading the international politics, or politics in general, through these autocrats or populist leaders now fully at play in the international stage, by way of, through the prism of personal interests, replacing what they should represent, actually, as leaders of the national interests in the countries that they are elected. The resemblance between people like Bolsonaro, Erdogan, Trump, striking in that sense, especially Trump and Erdogan, whose choreography in defining and engineering and designing politics is based on how they see their personal and their family's personal or family's interests. So reading that through that prism is interesting. Maybe it's more correct way of for journalists or think tankers to look at it that way these times, because they define history. This history is not, in this case, made by masses, but by persons.
And the impression that those figures give, I think one of the most dangerous thing narratives in Turkey, perspectives in Turkey right now, is to look at Erdogan's personal relationship with Trump and see that as a benefit for Turkey. Mm. And a lot of people see that. They say, why is this a problem for Turkey? Isn't it a good thing that our president has this direct channel to the U.S. leader, and that should benefit us? But in reality, what we're seeing is that it benefits Erdogan. It doesn't really benefit the Turkish people. If anything, it facilitates Erdogan's repression of the opposition in Turkey and destruction of Turkish democracy. So I think it's really important to complicate the picture and really document, show the ways in which this is really something that is a personal benefit to the Turkish leader, not to the Turkish people.
As one of the opinion shapers, a former military officer, put it, whatever is good for Erdogan and his family is bad for Turkey, and vice versa. I think that maybe sums it up all from that perspective, opposition perspective. But going back to personal interests, again, there is a lot of course, discussion, division in discussing Turkish-Greek crisis or tension or dispute, whatever you may want to call it, which has now transformed into, of course, naturally, to a Turkey-European Union crisis as days went by. And this overall picture is discussed in various ways. In Turkey, even opposition jumps on the ship that's been, you know, basically guided, captained by Erdogan, and all the rhetoric and discourse based on, you know, Turkish thesis in Eastern Mediterranean, etc. And in Turkey, whatever is left of the public discourse is centered around explaining or trying to find theories or develop theories about the so-called Blue Homeland doctrine, demarcation lines, Aegean islands, rocks and islets, etc., etc. Whereas perhaps the correct reading should be what the relationship between Erdogan's personal interests, his concerns about the domestic political scene, and the crisis that he deliberately blew up between Athens and Ankara, as perhaps should be interpreted. How do you see that from that perspective?
I do agree that we have to look at this crisis and take it beyond the narrow reading that this is really about Turkey, Greece, and maritime borders. That is exactly the impression that you get in Turkey in the domestic national conversation. We're debating this line, that line, the EEZ demarcation, or the maritime border, and what that means.
Even foreign pundits they join the debate and discuss creating this kind of equalization, as if this crisis is sort of naturally blown up or agitated by both sides equally, to this agenda. But it may not be the case. Maybe you disagree? I don't know.
No, I actually do agree, and I think it's important to explain that, because these maritime border disputes between Turkey and its neighbors, Greece, Cyprus, Eastern Mediterranean, has been an issue for years. It's nothing new. And yes, Turkey has certain grievances in this region, particularly concerning the gas, natural gas exploration off the coast of Cyprus that has been happening for multiple years. Turkey has been objecting to this because it is worried that Cyprus, at the end of the day, once those resources are able to be produced and shipped off and sold to Europe, will not share those benefits of those resources with northern Cypriots or Turkish Cypriots. This has been Turkey's grievance all along. But we have to remember that Cyprus has also its own grievances. Greece also has its grievances. This is diplomacy and international relations is about solving these differences that nations have with one another. But this, I agree with you, we should see it as a bit of a manufactured crisis, mm-hmm. because the fact that those disagreements have now reached a point of crisis where we are talking, just a few weeks ago, we were talking about potential real kinetic conflict between Greece and Turkey. This is because of Erdogan's choices and Turkey's foreign policy posture in this region. For the last couple of years, from the EU's perspective, from Europeans' perspective, also all of Turkey's neighbors in the Eastern Mediterranean have been seeing and Turkey asserts its claims in the region through gunboat diplomacy, through force. They're not seeing any kind of Turkish government that is trying to lead international negotiations and try to solve these through diplomatic mechanisms that we would normally expect a normal country to do. If you have a grievance, there are mechanisms that you can address that peacefully. But Turkey has not been interested in conducting a peaceful policy in this region. And I think that is the key problem. It's not the claims that Turkey's making. It's the way in which it's asserting them that is threatening all of Turkey's neighbors.
What's striking to me when I watch or follow these debates, both in Turkey, inside Turkey and outside, with the inclusion of lots of foreign pundits and analysts, almost nobody questioned why these exploratory talks that had been initiated by foreign ministers Yorgo Papandreou and Ismail Cem in 1999, which went on until March 2016. There were 60 of them, or 61 meetings between Athens and Ankara, involving senior, able diplomats from both sides. Nobody is questioning why these exploratory talks were abandoned in March 2016. Now everybody is more or less sort of arguing for the table, for the negotiations, for the return to the table. But nobody's questioning why these negotiations were discontinued. And mainly it was because Turkey discontinued them, because Erdogan was angered by, according to a very valid narrative, eight soldiers flying to Alexandroupolis and seeking asylum, and Athens refused to deport them, citing the lack of rule of law or torture, etc. And this was one of the main reasons for discontinuing these talks. However, this is an important aspect. If you argue for a return to the table, you should also question why these 61 meetings were abandoned. That struck me, basically.
Yeah. Why we have to question why diplomacy failed, mm-hmm. and whether there was a political will to make the diplomacy fail. Who are leading the negotiations between Turkey and Greece right now? From the Turkish side, we're seeing the figures who are leading it have pretty nationalist impulses and pretty uncompromising attitudes. Turkey has very able diplomats, creative diplomats who could sit down and negotiate and solve this in a peaceful way. It doesn't need to be a crisis. This doesn't need to be a crisis. I mean, it has been, there's this disagreement has been going on for years. it helps Erdogan domestically to right now have a crisis in the Eastern Mediterranean, or frankly, anywhere. I mean, this is what we're really talking about. I want to tie it back to the beginning of our conversation when we said we're right now seeing a Turkey that is guided by Erdogan's personal interests. Turkey's foreign policy has become hostage to Erdogan's personal interests at home. And right now, those interests are fanning the flames of nationalism, hyper-nationalism, and polarization in Turkish society, make Turkish people feel that Turkey is beleaguered by a host of enemies and terrorist groups and countries that are trying to constrain Turkish power from all sides, internal enemies, external enemies. And when people believe this, they end up supporting, even if they wouldn't under normal circumstances, a leader that they consider to be strong, which is Erdogan. Erdogan's popularity is the lowest it has been in the last 10 years. He very much recognizes it. And one way to keep the 50% threshold of support that he is able to coalesce together is through disruptive policies like this. But I think we have to stop and question what this is going to cost Turkey in the long term, because people are not going to forget these crises that Erdogan is manufacturing right now. And even if Turkey is able to get past this particular crisis without financial sanctions from the EU, I think the long-term consequences for Turkey are going to be extremely negative.
Mm-hmm. Final question. Josep Borrell, the de facto foreign minister of European Union, changed tune radically, I would say, from a softer colors to a much harsher colors. And he lately, in a statement talking about the summit coming up 24th and 25th of September, he several times in his speech statement said Turkey and European Union are at a watershed, at a very critical threshold, perhaps. And we talked about gunboat diplomacy, militarized foreign policy, Erdogan's interests, running the foreign policy, maybe hostage, lack of the role of foreign ministry of Turkey, which was a pillar of the Turkish Republic for decades. Do we see, and there are also talks that the exploratory talks would begin straight after the summit, although Erdogan downplays it, or his team downplays it, for maybe understandable reasons. How do you see the post-summit situation? What kind of watershed? What will be at the watershed? What will happen? Are you sort of optimistic or pessimistic? Will Turkey continue its own well-known, tough, assertive patterns or not?
I'm quite pessimistic, unfortunately, because I don't see Erdogan's foreign policy changing in any meaningful way. And by foreign policy, particularly this posture, Erdogan is going to continue to need to have a combative policy abroad in order to be able to keep his leadership position inside Turkey, to get enough votes or to delay elections using this as an excuse. So I think under a leader like Erdogan, we should expect a combative foreign policy, and that's going to continue. This is, I think the EU expects this too, and that's why we're hearing them saying this is a watershed moment. What that means, to call this that Turkey's at a crossroads with its relationship with the EU, they're saying that because they recognize this crisis is much more than about maritime borders or EEZ discussions. This is about, from the EU's perspective, and I think, you know, this is something that in Turkey we might dismiss easily, but from the EU's perspective, Turkey's democracy and human rights record, domestic governance is a pretty key, the nature of the regime is a pretty key component of how they see Turkey. For the last few years, we're seeing Erdogan with crackdowns on the opposition like never before. He does not, there is no democratic system left. There is no democratic decision making left in Turkey. So we're seeing a country that is becoming increasingly authoritarian, and that regime acting increasingly combative and aggressive abroad. This is what the how Turkey looks like from a European perspective right now. A country that is authoritarian at home and increasingly combative abroad. There are precedents for countries like this that have always caused major problems and threats for the stability of Europe everywhere else in the world, not just in Europe. But we have to understand that if this is the perspective, of course, they're going to call it watershed. I don't think the EU or any of Turkey's neighbors in this region expect Erdogan to behave any differently abroad, outside mm-hmm. Turkey's borders moving forward, because this is the type of trap of authoritarianism, when leaders become dependent on these manufactured crises abroad for their lead to keep their power, there's no incentive to change. There's no real recourse from that. And that's why I think even if we are able to get past the summit next week and the EU decides to issue no economic sanctions on Turkey, the long-term consequences of this behavior on the EU is going to remain the same.
That might embolden Erdogan further for his assertive, combative policy.
Yes, exactly. I think this is the expectation from all of Turkey's neighbors, knowing authoritarianism and seeing how Erdogan behaves both internally and externally.
I see. Let's leave it there. Merve Tahiroğlu, Turkey director of the Project on Middle East and Democracy in Washington, D.C., in short, POMED. Well, wonderful. Thank you for this conversation.
Great talking to you. Thank you.
Ahval podcastlerini tüm mobil telefonlarda Spotify, SoundCloud ve Spreaker üzerinden dinleyebilirsiniz. Apple iPhone kullanıcıları bize iTunes üzerinden de ulaşabilir. Türkiye'nin ve hayatın cıvıl cıvıl sesleri Ahval Podcast dizisinde. Kulağınız bizde olsun.